Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
It's time to wake to sleep with the number one sleep authority, Sleep Science Today, and Sleep Better Tonight.
Are you someone living with ADHD? How about someone on the autism spectrum disorder? Well, that may impact your sleep differently. We're going to learn about that today on this episode of Sleep Science Today. Today we have a guest, Alex Hinterton. Alex is a non-binary ADHD, that's AUDHD, covering autism and ADHD, psychologist, trauma-informed therapist in training in DBT, and a psychodietitian. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, we're glad to have you here. This is a topic that is a big topic, and we have not had the opportunity to cover it yet. So I'm going to start with questions on a lot of the basics here. Let's start with the concept of ADHD. Can you explain to us what is that? How would somebody know if it's impacting them? And what does it look like?
Yeah, so when it comes to ADHD, the official name is Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. And it's actually kind of misleading because it's not about attention deficit. It's more about that this attention works kind of differently. So, for example, we have the type inattentive, and it's more like it's difficult to focus on boring things. But at the same time, if it's something interesting, you can just dive deep, have a hyper focus, and it's difficult to get you out of this. So it's like if it's either interesting and you get the whole focus on it, or it's uninteresting, it's very difficult to focus on that. It's it can be also about forgetfulness, losing stuff, about issues with organizing time blindness. There's also, you can have issues with trying to get the correct details. And it's difficult to get to do things, especially when they are not exciting. So, you know, procrastination is a big thing. And you also have the second time, it's more a hyperactivity and impulsivity. So it's about more about the movement, that you have a lot of energy, that you need access. And for example, you need some kind of fidgets, you need to do something with your hands, with your legs, and you need to be constantly on the go. And at the same time, it's about being very talkative, impulsive, also when it comes to talking with others. So sometimes it might be about interrupting others, and it's not because you want to be rude, but because it's, you know, it just, you say quicker than you think. And it can also be about being impatient. And no, there's also the third type, which is the combination of both, and which I actually have. So you have, you know, symptoms from both.
So,
because it's focusing on the deficits when it comes to DCM, you know, the popular for diagnosis. But I come from the neurodivergence perspective, and I see also the positives in the ADHD.
So I'm going to get to the neurodivergent in a minute, but before we even get to that, and I mean, maybe we do have to get to that before I can ask you, but I was going to ask, when did you first realize that you were dealing with ADHD yourself? How old were you?
Oh, well, it was a process because I've been in therapy. Well, which is actually quite essential when you want to be a therapist, to go for your own therapy. And I've been dealing with various issues. And suddenly, like a few years ago, my therapist was diagnosed with ADHD. And she noticed that she was based on things that we actually shared, had in common. And she was like, hey, maybe you also have ADHD. And then, yeah, it turned out that I check all the points. So I had the full ADHD pie. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. All right. Well, maybe we should talk about the definition of, you know, autism spectrum disorder now, because then we can kind of talk about it all as a package there. So you know, give us a definition of autism spectrum. What does that look like? What would somebody kind of recognize if that was something that was impacting them or a family member?
Yeah, so when it comes to autism, it's also usually talked about deficits, but I prefer to talk about differences. And, you know, like in DSM, we usually have about deficits in communicating. We actually know now more that it's about differences. For example, we communicate differently. We have different body language, different face expressions, a different way of talking. We tend to be more direct, and we have a different basis for friendships and for functioning in the world. And at the same time, we have also the symptoms from B cluster, which is, for example, really lacking predictability and, you know, stability is something that is the same. So it might be sometimes difficult to deal with changes. It might be more difficult than for other people who aren't autistic. At the same time, there can be also stimming. So some repeatable movements that make you regulate your emotions. And that's how we deal with that. And there's also the thing about sensitivity, sensory sensitivity, and can it be, you know, that you're more sensitive to others, for example, for the light. Like the light for others is like, okay, but for autistic people, it might be too much, too bright, and can even cause headaches. On the other hand, you can also be sensitive, but less sensitive compared to neurotypical. For example, when you bump into something, someone might react that it's pain, it's terrible, and an autistic person who doesn't have that hypersensitivity but that has hyposensitivity, they may not just react, but they might not even notice that pain. Or, for example, they might need stronger sensory like activities. And for example, that's why sometimes we need weighted blankets, or like we can have spiky fidgets, because it gives more stimulation. And it's also important that sometimes it can be changeable. And like in one moment, this texture is perfect, and the other moment it can be terrible. So it can also be changeable in context of one person.
Wow. Wow. Okay. I didn't know that. So if you've got someone like yourself who has both of those, ADHD and neurodivergence, it sounds like it could be really confusing.
Yeah, actually, I usually call it that I'm a walking paradox.
Well, I'm just curious. What is a day like for you? How does that work?
Well, it's interesting. It's kind of like you have two wolves inside you. One has ADHD, one has autism. And sometimes they're like, yeah, yes, let's go with it. Like, we are in the agreement, and then it's like double push to do something. But sometimes they disagree. For example, ADHD wolf wants stimulation, wants something exciting, you know, novelty. And the autistic wolf is like, no, I want predictability, and they kind of disagreement. So like, you want novelty and predictability, stability at the same time. So sometimes it can be difficult. Sometimes it can, you know, work together. So for example, when there's a change, and my autistic wolf is like, oh no, change, I cannot. The ADHD wolf can be like, yeah, I'm gonna deal with it. Just give me to me. So they can also help each other. So that's a nice thing.
Wow.
And another thing, the last thing about autism spectrum that is also important, that a lot of autistic people have special interests. So this is like very specific passions. And they tend to just dip into those passions. And I actually have two special interests. And one is psychology. That's why I'm here. Especially in the neurodivergence context. And the second is cats. I love cats.
Wow. Okay. All right. So I'm still trying to get my head around the sort of the two wolves that you were describing, because they sound like they could be fighting with each other and conflicting.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, how do you manage that when you've got one saying, you know, one thing and the other saying the opposite? How do you manage that?
Yeah, it's about respecting both wolves, and sometimes you give more weight to the one wolf, but then on the other occasion you give more to the second wolf. So for example, if for ADHD wolf I go into social interaction, then for autistic wolf that needs rest, that needs, you know, peace, then I know that after that social interaction I need some peace, some time in being alone and doing, for example, things related to my special interest, right?
Wow. Okay. It's, you know, I'm trying to wrap my head around it and understand it and, you know, imagine what it must be like to experience that.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that there are a lot of misunderstandings and myths out there about both of these issues. What types of things do you normally hear, and what things should people know?
Well, first, as I said, you know, the name suggests that it's attention deficit. So people often think that ADHDers cannot focus at all. And, you know, that's what I used to think. And that's why I assumed I didn't have ADHD. Because, like, oh my gosh, those poor people with ADHD, they cannot focus at all. Like, oh, it must be so hard for them. And well, then it turned out I have ADHD. So yeah, they can focus, but their attention works differently and it's more focused on what's interesting, not necessarily what's important. It also right. can work more on the urgency issues, you know, like you cannot do it until it's very close to deadline. Then suddenly you can finally get into that. And for autism, there are a lot of myths as well. For example, that autistic people don't have empathy, which is like quite the opposite, because they are very empathetic people often. And there's also that issue of double empathy that we talked about. It's not like that we have deficits in communication. It's that like that neurotypical people, so those who don't have ADHD, who aren't autistic, they have their language. And we autistic people have our own language. And when there are two languages and we try to communicate, there's a barrier. It's not because one of the side is worse. It comes from both sides, you know? That's why we're trying to find the common language, and requires both sides to learn each other's language, right?
Right. Wow.
And also, you know, the myth that some people think that autistic people don't form connections or relationships, they don't care. Like, sure, there are some like that, but there are also some people like neurotypical who are like this. But a lot of autistic people actually crave connection. They still have their social needs, but they are just different.
So are there things that, you know, from a therapy perspective, since that's what your specialty, are there things that you can do to help people who are struggling with either one of the two?
Yes, actually, the first thing for ADHD, I usually propose, contact with the psychiatrist, because they usually have medications that they can help in everyday life, but also ADHD coaching and psychoeducation, because a lot of people receive instruction in their life how to work as a neurotypical person. They found out that they are not a neurotypical person, and they need different instructions. It's like, you know, you thought that you were as everyone else, that you had Windows system, right? So we try to work it as it is Windows. But then we found out it's actually Mac. And it doesn't mean that it's worse or better. It means that you need to work differently.
Right.
And that's how I actually teach ADHDers how to actually navigate your ADHD, so we can work with ADHD, not against that. Because that's not the thing. We're not trying to cure, to get rid of it, but actually minimalize the symptoms that we dislike, and maximize the positive things, so we can, you know, live the life we're living. And for autism, it's kind of similar, you know, with navigating. It's also about learning our language, our needs, also the sensory needs that often they have, autistic people often have that experience that, you know, being misunderstood and invalidating our needs. Because like, no, that light isn't that bright for everyone else. So like, no, the light is not that bright, but for autistic people it is. So they are learning that, okay, my needs are invalid. I shouldn't feel like this. So it's kind of a learning on, how actually we need to talk about needs, recognize them and fulfill them. At the same time, to understand why some neurotypical people do things that are kind of illogical to us, but, you know, to understand that maybe they don't have bad intentions, you know, be careful because they might not actually mean what they literally say. They might mean something different.
Right, right, right. So if someone is, because you mentioned like medications, especially for ADHD, if someone is given an ADHD medication, but they also are on the spectrum, is there anything that, you know, might come from that they need to be aware of? And before you answer that question, I'm going to stop us for our first commercial break. But when we come back, we're going to get the answer to that question. So stay tuned with us on Sleep Science Today, and we'll be right back after the break.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today.
All right, we're back on Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We are talking about ADHD and autism spectrum issues, and we're going to be getting into how they impact sleep. But before that, we had a question just before the break here, whether medication that someone takes for ADHD might have any impacts on someone who is neuroatypical.
Yes, so when it comes to the person who has ADHD and autism spectrum at the same time, some people recognize that, well, the ADHD symptoms kind of get lower, but the autistic side gets more visible. And sometimes it's just like they get diagnosed with ADHD, they get the medication, and they notice the autism signs more, and because of that, they get to be diagnosed with autism.
Right.
So sometimes it's like this. Also the thing is that, there is some research going on. We're still kind of trying to find out. So it's not like for sure we're still kind of trying to discover, but there is assumption that when it comes to for people who have ADHD and are autistic, it might kind of have less positive results. So it might be less effective in that, but we're still researching that and we're trying to see how we can make it better, right?
Great. Yeah, it sounds like it could get kind of complicated and challenging.
Mm. Yeah.
So, all right. So let's, you know, we have a good understanding of the background of each. So now let's bring that over into the world of sleep. What should we talk about when it comes to sleep issues for someone who has ADHD and is on the autism spectrum?
Well, first we should talk about that it kind of works differently, and that, you know, when it comes to statistics, ADHD or autistic people have tendency to have sleep issues and sleep disorders more often, unfortunately. And, you know, because of that poor sleep, it also affects how they function their life. So, for example, when you have ADHD and we have issues with attention, when they get poor sleep, it gets even worse, right? It gets even more difficult to focus. It's also more difficult to control impulsivity. When you have sensory sensitivity from autism, it might get even more sensitive if you had bad sleep. And, you know, unfortunately, the statistics also show that a lot of autistic and ADHD people have emotional dysregulation. And it can also get worse when you had a bad sleep, right? And also the things that ADHD and autism spectrum often co-occur with other disorders, for example, anxiety or like depression, burnout. And it also affects the sleep and it also affects the functioning. So it's kind of like a vicious cycle. And also the thing is that we still kind of have not enough, don't have enough research on that on the topic, especially when it comes to combining ADHD and autism. And at the same time, there's a lot of sleep research when it comes to neurodivergent children, but not a lot when it comes to adults. And it's usually from the neurotypical perspective. So thinking on, okay, how the sleep makes it more comfortable for other people, and not enough focus on how it affects the neurodivergent people themselves, like their psychological function and well-being.
So when you talk about, you know, okay, so on one hand, sure, poor sleep is never good for anybody, you know, regardless of the situation. But are there specific types of sleep issues that you would see more often with someone who is neurodivergent or ADHD?
Yes, actually, yes. When it comes to ADHD, we often recognize that those people have often delayed sleep phase syndrome. So their like inside clock usually prefers to sleep later than the casual person. That's why it might be difficult for the system that rewards early birds, so like getting up early and going to work, while usually ADHDers are kind of more like night owls and they prefer to work later and also sleep later. And and also when it comes to autism, for example, there's research that shows that there might be reduced REM sleep phase. Mm-hmm. And because of that, there might be also more awakenings and lower sleep efficiency. Also, when it comes to ADHD, we also find out that there are more percentage compared to neurotypical people when it comes to restless leg syndrome.
Really?
Yes. 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 Even up to like 40% of ADHD adults. So it also makes it more difficult to sleep. And you know, also you have the characteristics of ADHD and autism itself that make it more difficult to sleep. For example, if you have ADHD, which is often about hyperactivity, you want to do something constantly. You have a lot of thoughts like at the same time. And, you know, you don't get to turn off your ADHD for night. So when you go to sleep, ADHD is still there. There are still a lot of racing thoughts, and they don't have to be anxiety thoughts. They can be like racing thoughts like, okay, I wonder how male bees function, or like how much of vitamin C passion fruit has, you know? It's like you have all those thoughts, racing thoughts, and well, when you have a lot of those thoughts, the body gets tense as well, and you also can get that restless leg syndrome. Also can have the hyperactivity and that tension that you need to do something. So it makes it even more difficult to sleep, right?
Right.
Fall asleep. And when it comes to autism, you also have like, you know, sensory of, things. So it might be difficult to get the right environment because, you know, there might be some lights that are disturbing. There can be also sounds that are too loud, even if they are not loud for other people. The texture, the smells, the temperature, they might be more sensitive to that. So it might be even more difficult to have a nice sleep. And at the same time, it's also about transition. Because when it comes to people, autistic people, they often have some issues with transition from one activity to the other activity. Because it's a change, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when you have a day full of activities and then you're supposed to transition to sleep, it can be to too immediate and might be too sudden. It might be too difficult to just like go switch on, switch off, right?
Right. So, all right. So let's talk about the first part there when you were talking about someone with ADHD and their brain is very active and they're thinking about all these things. And so they're having trouble sleeping. If you're working with a client like that, what types of things can they do to help themselves, you know, improve their sleep?
Yeah. So besides the medical options, because you can also take melatonin to make your cycle more friendly to the early bird. That's one of the options. But when it comes to psychological, we usually work on organizing time so you can prepare yourself for bedtime routines to give you the signs for your body that, okay, we're going not to go to sleep. You can also do like brain dump before sleep. So you just take a piece of paper and you write all the thoughts that you have. And then kind of gets out of the heads and they can stay here and you don't have to worry that you're going to forget them. They're going to stay here. And another thing that a lot of ADHDers fall asleep better when there's something in the background, like some kind of noise, maybe some kind of music or repeatable video, like from YouTube, for example. Because they can focus their stream of thoughts on what's going on in the background and kind of also cancels, you know, the random background noise that always, you know, and they're distracting. So they don't have to focus on the racing thoughts. They have like the thing that they can focus on so they can finally fall asleep.
So if they're focusing on something else, like you said, something from YouTube or whatever, what types of things should they be opting for? Are there things that are more calming to them so that that doesn't just generate a whole other set of thoughts?
Yeah, it's usually should be more calming. Sometimes there are like video essays that they don't have drastic changes in, you know, in sounds or like they're like sudden boo and something like that, because there are some videos like that. So more like calmer video essays can be nice. There's also some podcasts that actually produce like podcasts to actually fall asleep to. So I'm thinking that maybe there was some ADHD there that kind of thought of that. And also that can be like some kind of calm music and there can be some kind of white noise. It can also be helpful for some ADHDers.
What about, I know there's so many, what is it? ASMR? Is that, am I saying it right? Am I having a
yeah, yeah.
So are those effective for either group?
Yeah, they can work as long as it's not like very disruptive. It's kind of calm. It has a pattern. Obviously, it's not going to work for everyone. So it's always a kind of experiment on which kind of background stimulation works for us the best.
So if you had the opportunity to, you know, blank canvas, and you were going to design the perfect bedroom for someone who is, you know, on the spectrum, and you want to be able to create the perfect environment, what types of things would you think about?
Well, obviously, it also kind of depends on the specific person, because it's a spectrum, so we can have different things. But what I would take into account, what the lights. So maybe if someone is very sensitive to light, maybe they need some you know, cover for the eyes or cover, very dark cover for the windows so they don't see any light. So let's add darkness. Or on the other hand, some people actually prefer to have some light and they feel safer. So maybe there's some light contact that you can have or like some little lamp that, or like, there are some like star stickers that kind of, you know, shine in the darkness.
Right. I've seen those.
Another thing is, you know, the sound. So, for example, it can be either that you need that simulation. So, yeah, something playing in the background. So it can also kind of tone down the random noises that can distract you and, like, can alarm you. And on the other hand, sometimes people prefer to have total silence. And, for example, they might sleep in noise cancellation headphones.
Okay.
Well, that's an option too. Another thing that would be very important to take into account, so textures. For example, the texture of your pillow, the texture of your duvet, of the sheet. So, because autistic people very often are very sensitive to texture, and if it's not the right texture, it might be like hell. And it's kind of difficult to fall asleep when you're in hell, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, so, and it might also be about, you know, kind of having the weight. For example, it's been found out that for autistic and maybe also some ADHDers, it might be helpful to have weighted blankets, like around 10% of the body mass, and can make them sleep better because they have like something put them, like some kind of touch, like some kind of And so, you know, some people also benefit from plushies.
They
can feel nice. It can also be considered, you know, about smells, whether you need to have no smells at all, or maybe you have to want to have a calm smell, like lavender, for example. So yeah, a lot of focus on sensory things, that's for sure.
Okay, well, those are a lot of great examples. I have a follow-up question about textures, but before I ask that, we actually have to take our second break here. So we're going to take a break on Sleep Science Today. We'll be back, and we're going to follow up on some of the texture issues. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
The station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today.
All right, welcome back to Sleep Science Today. We were just following up on textures. We were talking about neurodivergent people and sleep. So you were talking about textures in the bed, and I'm thinking to myself, because I'm curious. So I guess there's sheets made out of different materials. Some are more satiny and smooth. Some are more rough and harsh. Is that what you mean by some of the textures? Like, is there a big enough difference between different types of sheet materials and things that might impact someone?
For an autistic person, it can be. It can be subtle for someone. Someone else might not notice it, but if you have a very high sensitivity to textures as an autistic person, it might be like, obviously, and like you cannot think about something else because it just disturbs you. It makes you even more tense. So that's not a good state of body to fall asleep, right? For example, I remember when there was a night and I received a blanket to sleep under. It had a terrible texture. It was like kind of scratchy, and like for others it would be fine, but for me it was terrible. And I actually preferred to sleep without blanket, even if I was a bit cold, than with the blanket. That's how important it was.
Interesting. So I guess, you know, when we're talking about neurodivergent people dealing with texture, it'll be different for everybody. In other words, somebody might like a more scratchy texture, whereas someone else might like a more satiny texture. Is that right? It's different for each person.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a spectrum. Like we can say that, okay, most autistic people usually tend to have, to like the softest textures, but there are also some that will have some harsh textures. So like, you know, it's a spectrum. We need to find out, explore individually. That's why it's a big part of my work, to explore individually the sensory profile of the client that I work with.
Okay. What about diet? Does that have anything, any impact?
Well, definitely. We know from other research that in general, yeah, diet affects affects our sleep, no matter if you're neurotypical or neurodivergent. But the thing about neurodivergent people is that from statistics, they are more often prone to Western diets, so full of like processed fat and like sugar and not the healthy stuff. And so, well, it also makes the sleep issues even worse. And there's also the thing about remembering to eat, especially when it comes to ADHD people. Like, they can literally forget to eat.
Wow.
For a whole day. And then they could, for example, because of that, get very hungry in the evening and, you know, eat a lot, like binge. And because of that, well, they're going to have a bad sleep, or they might not be able to fall asleep. And on the other hand, you have autistic people who often have like also texture sensitivities when it comes to food. So they can have food selectivity, and there are some foods that they just not acceptable. And it can also influence that, like, you know, some foods would be better for a better sleep, but they cannot eat it because of the texture.
Wow. Yeah. You know, I never thought about that. I never had a reason to dig into this deeply. So I'm learning a lot from you. So I understand that the texture issue with food, and that can be obviously a very big, big thing. In general, are there diets, like types of foods and things that are more recommended for someone who is neurodivergent to help them to sort of manage things? Are there certain foods that tend to be better or not? Or is it really just comes down to what works for them?
Well, when it comes to nutrition, those are basically the same as for neurotypical people. So Mediterranean diet, for example, is like one of the healthiest recommended diets. The issue is how to actually implement it when you have a lot of food selectivity and when you also have ADHD, so it's hard to plan the food, and, you know, you also impulsively eat something, and, you know, because of that, it's more likely that you're gonna get some highly processed food just because it's fast. You don't have to prepare it. And from autistic perspective, it usually tastes the same as the opposite for the fruit and vegetables, which usually differ in the taste, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Well, yeah, I was listening to a radio show myself just the other day, and I found this to be interesting, so I'll share it with the audience. It was a scientist who was looking at, you know, an easy way to determine whether food is highly processed or not. And they said, you simply take the food, you put it in a glass of water, you wait 3 hours. And if it's highly processed, it's going to just fall apart and turn into mush. Whereas if it's more natural food and natural grains, it's going to stay together. So for example, if I were to buy a loaf of bread somewhere in Europe and do that, they have much cleaner ingredients. It would probably stay together and not be highly processed. In the US, you have a lot of additives and a lot of other things. So you take the same thing that you think is the same bread, but it's got different ingredients. You put it in the water, you come back, and it's just fallen into mush. So it's just an easy way to kind of test foods to make sure whether or not you're dealing with something highly processed or not. So I just thought I'd share that.
And that's actually another issue with the highly processed. It's more durable. So like for the ADHDers who tend to forget that they actually have bought food, so they can have rotten fruit, rotten vegetables, and the durable, highly processed foods are still, they can still eat it. So where are they going to choose the food to eat that they can still eat, not the rotten one, you know?
Right.
So it also makes it even difficult. And for example, also when it comes to autism, you can also have like one day you can love this food and the other day you can hate it. So for example, you bought a lot of kiwis because you love kiwis, and the next day you hate it. And well, it's difficult. The kiwi is going to get rotten. But if, for example, they bought like a highly processed chocolate food, if they hate it the other day, they still have a lot of weeks, months even, to come back to liking it, right?
Really? So the lights switch constantly like that? I didn't know that.
I mean, it can. Some of the things that can be constant, like constantly hate some green vegetables, but some of them are very specific. And for example, like one day I'm gonna eat a lot of kiwis, and for weeks I'm gonna eat a lot of kiwis, and then one day it's just like nope, and for another month no kiwis. It's kind of unpredictable in that.
That's got to be really difficult for parents of children, because they're trying to buy the things that they think their child likes, and then it just switches on them.
Yeah, it's actually kind of a similar thing to cats. Like when you have a cat and you notice that they like certain food, so you buy a lot of that, and the next day the cat is like, I'm not going to eat it. Nope. So it's kind of similar to that. It's like, right. Like being rude, but you know, it just like, it happens.
Wow. Wow. Okay. See, I'm learning a lot of things here. So can you share with us a little bit about your own story in terms of what types of challenges did you find yourself having, and how did you kind of overcome those challenges as you learned about psychology, as you started to work with clients? Just give us a sense of what, you know, what your life is like and how you manage things.
Well, it's still a work in progress, so I'm still working on that. But I have come up with some mechanisms that make it better. So it's like working on being 1% better in my diet. So it's not like I'm not going to pretend that I'm going to have a perfectly healthy diet. It's not going to be possible. But, you know, to make it more healthier. So, for example, I prepare some things and I freeze them so I can have them put for later. When I prepare some cooked meals, sometimes I also prepare in different batches. So, for example, separately I prepare rice, and separately I prepare the sauce and the vegetables, so I can mix them depending on what my taste likes. Uh-oh. And so I don't have to force myself to one kind of meal. And if I like this meal, but one day I'm like, no, I'm not gonna eat rice, then it's not gonna go to waste because I can replace rice with something else, right? And I also tend to prepare the fruit and vegetables before, so I can have it easy to grab and suck. And sometimes, you know, it's also about some compromises. So sometimes I'll also buy pre-packed things, especially when I'm in a hurry, just to eat something healthier. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes you also prepare some from half-produced products. So, like, it's not that healthy, but it's healthier than if it was fully processed, right?
Right, right.
It's about, you know, the compromises between being more healthier, getting more protein, vitamins, minerals, and so on. And also, like, being edible for me. And also, the thing about forgetting to eat, I actually set alarms on my phone so I don't forget to eat.
Smart. See, these are all fantastic tips, because I wouldn't have thought about the fact of preparing the separate foods separately, and then you can mix and match as you need. The idea of preparing things and then freezing them, so that allows you to have quality food that maybe you're not in the mood for this week, but next week, like you said, you might have a taste for it again. Those are some important tips.
Yeah, and there's also that compromise. For example, when it comes to compromise between my ADHD and autism. For Artistic Wolf, I have, like, every day I have oatmeal. And this is, you know, stable. Every day I know it's predictable. But for ADHD Wolf, I add different things. So one day it might be strawberries, the other day it might be raspberries, and so on. So it kind of gets novelty every day. So they can both be happy.
Right. Wow. Well, this has been very educational, and I'm sure that your clients are lucky to have someone like you who has this level of training and knowledge and understanding, because a lot of people don't. And the fact that you're living it real life, you really truly understand it from your own perspective. So, you know, that's really, really helpful. So, we actually, I'm looking at my timer here, we actually are out of time for our show, but this has been very educational, something that we have not covered before, and I really appreciate the opportunity to learn from you. Any final comments or tips for the audience before we wind up?
Well, be prepared that if you're neurodivergent, you might be more likely to have sleep problems, but it's not a death sentence. You can work on that. You just need to get to know your ADHD or autism or both better. So you can work with that, not against that.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, this has been Alex Hinterton. So we really appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us. For those
of you
listening.
Thank you for having me.
Yep. Thank you. And for those of you listening, follow us on sleepsciencetoday.com and you can find all of our other episodes, lots and lots of topics about sleep. And we look forward to seeing you there. We look forward to seeing you on our next show.
You have been listening to Sleep Science Today, your number one sleep authority.
Sleep Science Today.